Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's April 21st, 2015 8th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 6, Registered Funds, Considerations for Alternative Investment Managers. Timothy Levin and Paul Raymond will discuss the major considerations for alternative managers going into the registered funds distribution channel. Now, on to the podcast.
I'm Tim Levin. I'm a funds partner in the Philadelphia office, and I'm happy to be joined today by Paul Raymond, who is also a funds partner resident in the Boston office. We're talking about registered funds briefly. The idea here is not to provide an overview of requirements for registered funds, although we'll touch on that a little bit, but really to talk a little bit about what Paul and I and others at the firm are seeing as major considerations for alternative managers who are going into the registered funds distribution channel. The first aspect of this that we need to consider is why register under the 40 Act, or why have a product that's registered under the 40 Act. And these are the key reasons. One is you get around the private fund offering limitations, so either the QP requirements or the 100-person limitations. You can go out and make a public offering. There's the potential for a more retail distribution audience, an unlimited amount of ERISA plan assets. This is one that actually is quite attractive in a lot of ways, is that under the ERISA rules, the registered investment companies are not treated as plan assets. And then if this is an issue for you, it's an opportunity to obtain efficiencies for combining multiple separately managed accounts into a single pooled investment vehicle. But I think if you look at all of those, everybody knows that the real sort of one-word answer is distribution. And we're going to talk a little bit about how to get that distribution, what some of the trade-offs and the different structures are. For example, one of the things that managers often have to consider is, how am I going to manage a registered fund in a way that's consistent from a commercial perspective with what I'm doing with my private funds? So for just a quick example, it's great to get the additional distribution. I'm getting paid 2 and 20 to run a multi-billion dollar hedge fund, or you know, something like 2 and 20 with a performance fee. I can't do that in the registered fund. So how am I going to not just differentiate the product, but differentiate my investment strategy? And we're going to talk a little bit about sort of where the levers that you can pull to think about how you go about doing that. Paul's going to talk a little bit about the main types of registered funds that we see people using.
Sure. And, you know, alternative strategies have clearly migrated into the registered fund world. According to McKinsey, the broad category of alternative registered funds, which includes mutual funds, ETFs, and closed-end funds, has grown 16% annually since 2005 and now stands at almost $900 billion. Based on this growth, which McKinsey projects is going to continue, it's really no surprise that we're seeing our registered fund clients anxious to supplement their alternative fund offerings, and also historically hedge fund managers interested in entering the registered fund space. Also, really no surprise with this rapid growth that this has piqued the interest of the SEC, which recently conducted a sweep exam of alternative mutual funds, has included alternative investment companies among its 2015 exam priorities, and has brought enforcement proceedings against managers to alternative funds for violations of the 40 Act. As Tim mentioned, you know, we're working regularly with managers to determine whether their alternative strategies can work within the confines of a registered investment company. And part of that process is to determine which type of registered fund vehicle to use. You know, mutual funds have the benefit of broad market acceptance and I think have accelerated as the vehicle of choice for alternative strategies. They can make a continuous public offering to an unlimited number of investors with no investor qualification requirements. However, there are some regulations specific to mutual funds that could knock your alternative strategy out of the mutual fund box. For example, mutual funds must stand ready to redeem their shares each day and generally must pay redemption proceeds within 7 days of a redemption request. For this reason, mutual funds are prohibited from investing more than 15% of their assets in illiquid securities. A security is generally considered illiquid if it cannot be sold at approximately its carrying value within 7 days. And it's this cap on illiquid securities that will require managers investing to any real extent in illiquid asset classes to look to a closed-end fund vehicle. I think I'll skip over ETFs as a separate panel this afternoon on ETFs and hand it back to Tim to discuss closed-end funds.
So if you're not gonna go with the open-end fund model, that sort of sends you to the closed-end fund model, which may be because of either the limitation on investing in illiquid securities that Paul mentioned, or also because of concerns about the daily cash flows that mutual funds experience. You know, I think Paul indicated issuing redeemable securities means being ready to liquidate an investor's holdings on a daily basis. In contrast, on closed-end funds, you're not subject to those requirements. There are really two flavors of closed-end funds. The first that we've got here is the listed closed-end funds, and this is the traditional type of closed-end fund that essentially does an IPO. It's an underwritten offering. The underwriting syndicate puts together an IPO. You raise a certain amount of capital. You may have an opportunity to increase that in some ways in the future, but really what it involves is doing an IPO, and then you have a truly permanent capital vehicle because the shares list on an exchange, and investors can either buy in or obtain liquidity by trading the shares on the exchange. One byproduct of that is that there can be a disconnect between the market price of the shares and the net asset value of the fund. This is something that when shares are trading at a premium is a good thing. When shares are trading at a discount, neither investors typically think that's a good thing, and it also opens up the possibility for activist investors to come in and seek to force management to take action in some way to minimize the discount. Those have been problematic issues for alternative managers. I think where we've seen more frequently is that the alternative space has seen development in the unlisted closed-end funds. These are sometimes called interval funds, although there is a distinction between a fund that is a closed-end fund that does periodic tender offers versus a closed-end fund that is a true, what we call a true interval fund, and relies on Rule 23C-3 under the Investment Company Act. The basics of the structure are that it's a registered investment company. It does not issue redeemable shares. Shares can be continuously offered, although typically what that means is that you have monthly or perhaps quarterly openings. And investors get periodic liquidity through either tender offers or repurchase offers, which usually are done on a quarterly basis, and it's possible to impose lockups and things like that. The fund in this case has to maintain sufficient liquidity in order to satisfy whatever its commitments are to make repurchases and or tender offers, but there is no strict requirement that these funds maintain a certain percentage of their assets in liquid securities. It can be offered publicly or privately, and depending upon the structure, it can be structured to provide a K-1 or a 1099, depending upon whether the fund is going to be taxed as a partnership or taxed as a RIC. And I realize that I've gone through these characteristics pretty quickly. I just note that after our slide presentation in the book that you have, there is a chart that compares these types of entities in fairly substantial detail, but it's beyond the scope of our panel to go through all that detail, as you'll see once you, if you look at the chart.
And I think the next section of our presentation really contains and lists a number of key registered fund regulations, and given the limited time we have this morning, we're only going to plan to touch on a few of them. And first, on slide 7, wanted to highlight that performance fees are only allowed in a registered fund if each investor in the fund is a qualified client. A qualified client is generally a person with $1 million or more of assets under management with a manager, or a net worth of at least $2 million. Also wanted to mention that the heart of the 40 Act is its restrictions on affiliated transactions. And transactions between or involving a registered fund and its affiliates generally either prohibited or permitted only with limitations. One other item wanted to flag on this slide was the treatment of trade errors in the registered fund space. It is an industry practice that registered funds be made whole for all trade errors, and the SEC and fund boards expect this to be the case.
Yeah, the topic of trade errors is something where Paul and I were discussing this, that we've had clients who have been on both sides of that question, and it's a very challenging one because on the one hand, you don't want to agree to something that goes beyond what the legally required standard is, although it's important as an alternatives manager, if you're going to go into the registered fund area, it is almost the universal expectation of fund management fund boards and the SEC that there is essentially something close to strict liability for trade errors. And that's very important to have your eyes open when you're going into that. Some additional terms here. I think the main thing to focus on in this slide is that the mutual funds and other registered funds have been subjected to very significant SEC scrutiny around valuation practices. It is necessary, in accordance with the Investment Company Act, for the board of the fund to have responsibility for fair valuation of the fund's shares, and that includes fairly direct oversight of securities that might be fair valued. There have been a number of SEC enforcement proceedings in this area in the recent years, and it's another area where if you're an alternatives manager, this is something to be aware of as just sort of a step up in scrutiny in the registered funds area versus what you would typically see in the unregistered funds.
In terms of the ways you can enter the registered fund space, you know, we really see four basic structures regularly used by alternative managers to access the registered fund space. And this morning we'll try to give you a brief overview of each of those structures and really try to hit on the major pros and cons of each. Option number one is a standalone fund structure. In this structure, you know, the manager launches its own proprietary fund complex, and this really involves building the complex from the ground up. The manager needs to organize the trust, assemble a board, retain service providers. A compliance infrastructure needs to be built out. You know, compliance policies and procedures need to be prepared. A fund CCO needs to be designated. And a compliance program needs to be implemented and administered. There's also a variety of SEC and other filings that need to be made, and all of this takes time and resources. For a new registrant, this process usually takes to launch your first fund about 4 months, though the process may be extended some if your first fund is pursuing a novel strategy, which may take a little bit more time to get through the SEC. In terms of kind of major pros and cons of having a proprietary fund complex, it gives the manager the most control over the fund and its marketing and distribution. For example, the manager's going to have an active role in the selection of the board members, including the independent trustees. But it also involves increased time to market and startup and operational costs versus a turnkey trust solution, which is another kind of access point into the space. And I think Tim's going to discuss that option now.
I think the other thing about the standalone fund structure that's important is that this is the structure that, as Paul said, offers the most control, but it offers the greatest amount of entrepreneurial risk too. Remember, it's the manager's name is on the door, and there's nobody else in this product structure really to take responsibility in the event that somebody needs to step up and provide support to the fund. This is the manager's baby. So the next alternative here, and Paul and I are sort of going along a spectrum of different types of products, is the turnkey fund platform. Turnkey fund platforms have grown significantly over the last 10 years, and this is an area where we've seen a number of alternative managers using this type of a product to enter the registered fund market. Essentially, what happens is various service providers who are in the business of really their core business is providing fund accounting and fund administration services have created these platforms where they take all of the back office function and all of the management function, like organizing board meetings and managing registration statement, drafting and filing, and create that as a platform and then allow managers the opportunity to launch a fund on the platform. If you were to look at the offering documents for the fund, what you would see is that it looks like ABC Manager Fund. They're pretty well labeled so that if you're just looking at the face of things, you would have no reason to know that this wasn't ABC Manager's proprietary fund, but rather it was on one of these platforms. And for that reason, they're known as turnkey funds. The main advantages to this are that it's less costly to launch. They have lower operating costs because many of these platforms are operating with many billions of dollars in fund assets, and so you do get economies of scale in a lot of areas. It's less time consuming. When you're not going from scratch, as Paul described, you really can get onto these platforms probably within 90 days, I'd say, is not uncommon, 120 days perhaps at the longer end. So you've got a shorter time to market. The disadvantage, though, is that you do have less control over the product. The fund board has already been selected and probably has some pretty well-established business practices and some well-established preferences and dislikes for the way that things are done. And there is, you know, on the platform sponsor side, they have a certain amount of entrepreneurial risk here and want to make sure that their product is not going to be jeopardized by risks that the manager is wanting to take in the product. And so there's a little bit more potential for tension there.
Yeah, and I think these platforms have really evolved from kind of what used to be referred to as incubator trusts, where you'd get sufficient scale and leave, to I think we're seeing more and more managers leave their funds on these turnkey series trust solutions as they grow, as Tim mentioned, well beyond scale, just because from kind of an administrative ease, it makes the manager's life more easier and they can focus on managing money rather than some of the administrative aspects that the administrator can really focus on.
So the next model is the joint venture model. This one is a little bit less common, but we have seen it in a number of instances. And the idea is that the alternatives manager chooses somebody who is already well established in the traditional asset management space as a primary partner. That primary partner would already have a family of mutual funds and so has all the infrastructure necessary in order to support the registered fund product. And what they do is actually enter into a joint venture agreement or some other agreement that governs their conduct with each other. So this is typically a very, very detailed and in-depth agreement that has allocation of responsibility for different aspects of running things. The alternatives manager usually is most focused on having freedom to run the investment strategies the way that the alt manager wants to run the strategies and branding and marketing, whereas the traditional manager usually will want to maintain greater control over sort of the mechanics of running the platform, and also what the traditional manager is bringing is usually the distribution network as well. The advantage is it allows for shared expertise and resources from two different partners. From the manager, the alt manager's perspective, you have probably greater control than you would in a sub-advisory role, which we'll talk about in a minute. And you get to step onto a fairly robust platform. Again, the main drawback here is that you don't have the same autonomy as you would on the turnkey, but you've got a lower cost that goes with that.
And then looking at the sub-advisory role, as I think I mentioned earlier, you know, many registered fund managers are really chomping at the bit to add alternative fund offerings to their lineups. And registered fund managers, particularly those that operate as managers of managers, are retaining alternative managers to either sub-advise entire funds or sleeves of funds. And I think we're seeing a trend among managers of a kind of willingness to retain sub-advisors who are new to the 40-Act space to manage alternative mandates. Acting as a sub-advisor to someone else's fund has its benefits. It's less costly and time-consuming than launching and overseeing your own fund, but also has some major disadvantages. You may be terminated any time. The manager of the fund may decide to allocate a substantial amount of assets away from you at any time. And also the sub-advisory fee you typically charge in a sub-advisory role would be less than what you would command as the fund's manager. So it's perhaps the easiest and quickest access point into the registered fund space, but given the drawbacks, you know, it's just something to consider. And I think all of these options have their pros and cons, and I think it's really the position you're in and kind of what you're looking to do, which will dictate kind of which of the routes you travel.
As we went through the four, as you could probably tell, there's this spectrum of commercial opportunity and commitment at one end, ease of entry and least amount of commitment at the other end. Least cost comes with that, and it's a question of deciding where your ideal entry point's going to be. And you may even find that you want to go in at two different entry points.
To listen to other panels from the 2015 8th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.